Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take our third look at the Ypsilanti Ripper. Before we get going this week, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow the show on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple of ways you can do this. You can go to your favorite podcast app, subscribe to the show, and leave a 5-star review. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon for as little as $1.99 a month. You can get access to early ad-free shows, as well as exclusive content, just as my friends Channel and Anthony did, as well as the largest Patreon contributors monthly, Samantha, Debbie, Mark, and Betty. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you get access to early ad-free shows and exclusive content. And if you don't like the show, just move along. Don't leave a nasty review to show everyone you got a tiny pecker. All right, now that all that's out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair. Kick back and relax. I've got my coffee. I've got my cigarettes. Let's go in the crypt. When we left off last week, two murders had been committed, both bearing some striking similarities to one another. But the police had been able to make very little headway. However, they had been led to the doorstep of a young man by the name of John Norman Collins. But beyond that, there were few clues and very little in the way of witnesses to point the police in the direction of who might have been responsible for these crimes. And unfortunately, as with the murder of Mary Therese Flezar, the murder of Joan Elspeth Schell also went cold. And it would be a little over 8 months until anything further occurred. On the morning of May 21st, 1969, in Denton, Michigan, which is in Van Buren Township, about 4 to 5 miles east of Ypsilanti, a mother rushed her son out of the front door to go catch his bus, which was due to pick him up down the street at any moment. The boy had left a few moments beforehand, only to return carrying a department store shopping bag from J.L. Hudson's. When asked where he had found this bag, the young boy informed his mother that he had discovered it across the street from the cemetery, sitting on the side of the road. The area where this home and this cemetery stood were fairly rural, surrounded by mostly dairy farms and undeveloped tracts of land. The mother had quickly looked inside of the bag and seen that there was a shoebox inside that was wrapped in wrapping paper and tied with ribbons and a bow, inside of which there was a birthday card that read, quote, "Dearest Mom, sorry I'm late, but in 100 years you'll never know the difference. I love you, Janie." Obviously, the mother has no idea who Janie is, and realizing the time and not wanting to have to drive her young son to school, she shoos him out the door. According to statements from the mother, after her son had walked out the door, she went back to look at the bag again, picking it up and putting her hands underneath it, and at this point, she felt something sticky against one of her hands, and raising the bag so that she could see beneath it, she saw two small red stains, which she immediately knew was blood. The mother ends up rushing out of the house to see what's going on, as well as to check on her son. Driving down the street, Thankfully, there was no sight of her son. However, just inside the cemetery gates, she saw something lying on the ground, draped in yellow. Now, this woman stated that she parked her car on the side of the road and approached the cemetery gates. And upon getting close enough, she realized that what she was seeing draped beneath some yellow covering was in fact a human body. Not only the body of a human, but the body of a woman, covered by a raincoat. The woman was lying supine on her back with the left arm bent, the forearm resting up across her eyes, almost as though she had fainted. At this point, the woman becomes hysterical and rushes back to her house, contacting the local police department. According to police documents, they received the call and arrived on scene not long afterwards. This was a pair of state troopers. The woman and her husband soon joined the officers out by the cemetery, at which point the woman gave the rundown of how she had come across the body, the bag that her son had found, and her discovery of the drops of blood on the bottom of the bag. Officers examined the bag as well as the shoebox wrapped in wrapping paper and discovered that they contained a pair of fuzzy blue slippers. There was also some papers inside of the bag, which they quickly realized more likely than not belonged to a college student. Now, one of these officers, Detective Sergeant Taylor, asks if he can use this family's phone. They obviously agree with this, and Taylor contacts the state police barracks. That morning when he had come in, he had seen a missing persons report from Grand Haven. Taylor learns that the missing person report was on a 23-year-old University of Michigan law student named Jane Louise Mixer. Miss Mixer was listed as being 5'4", 110 pounds, short brown hair, and a first-year law student at the University of Michigan. He asks if someone can go over to the University of Michigan and obtain a copy of the previous year's yearbook, hoping to find a picture of the missing girl in order to see if this missing college student is in fact the young woman lying dead in the cemetery down the street. After this, Taylor questions the mother and father, wanting to know if they had seen or heard anything unusual in the previous 24 hours. While the husband states he heard and saw nothing, the wife says that she had seen a car pulling out of the cemetery around midnight the previous evening as she was returning from getting a hamburger with a friend. She stated that the car was a white station wagon. It had pulled out of the cemetery gates and driven in the opposite direction that they were going, so basically driving back towards town. She was unable to make out any specific details of the car, nor was she able to give a description of the driver. She did inform Officer Taylor that oftentimes high school students, as well as some college students, would drive out to the cemetery and use it as something of a local lover's lane. After questioning the couple further, Taylor returns to the cemetery where more detectives as well as crime scene technicians have arrived. they quickly begin processing the scene, and Taylor begins to fill in the other detectives on everything he has learned so far, as well as his fear that the young woman lying feet away from them may in fact be Jane Louise Mixer. The cops start looking at the crime scene once the raincoat is removed, and it's discovered that the victim is fully clothed, although her skirt has been hiked up to just above her vaginal area. The stockings that she is wearing have been pulled down to just the top of her thighs, while one shoe rests on her stomach, with the toe pointing downwards and resting on the pubic area. There was also a garrote tied around her throat. Officers noted a small wound to the victim's forehead. Later, it was determined that the victim had been shot twice in the head with a .22 caliber pistol, once in the forehead and once in the back of the head before being garroted by a pair of nylon stockings that did not belong to her. It was also learned that the victim was going through her menstrual cycle, which is more likely than not the reason that she was found to not have been sexually assaulted. Now, at the crime scene, it was found that there was a overnight bag with women's clothing, toiletries, etc., and a copy of the book Catch 22 lying next to the body. There was also a shoe print in the mud nearby, and tire tracks. Police made plaster casts of these last two items. The police learned that some youths had seen a station wagon in the area the previous night. However, they stated this vehicle was green and that it was slowly driving back and forth in front of the cemetery. Obviously, the police are able to identify the victim as being 23-year-old Jane Louise Mixer. And they learn that Jane had been traveling across the state to see her family. This was ostensibly to make up for forgetting her mother's birthday, but there was another reason for this. Jane Mixer had been planning on informing her parents of her engagement and plans to drop out of college and move to New York City. Jane's fiancé being a 35-year-old instructor at the University of Michigan Law School. Now, Jane did not have her own car, so she had put up a note on the notice board on campus asking anyone if they were driving out to Muskegon, which is roughly 165, 175 miles from Ann Arbor. Someone had answered her ad, and Jean had not informed anyone who this individual was, only that she had found a ride. Jane had left on a Thursday, intending it to be a long weekend. However, by Thursday evening, when she had not arrived home, her father, a doctor, called Jane's room at the University of Michigan Law School, was not able to get an answer, at which point he called her fiancé, who informed him that he had not heard anything from her either. The only information that her fiancé was able to tell Jane's father was that she had been on campus at around 6 o'clock that evening, and that he had no idea who it was that was giving Jane a lift. After this phone call, it's known that her fiancé contacted Jane's room on a number of occasions, all to no avail. At 1:30 on Friday morning, Jane's father contacted the Muskegon police, who informed him that it would be in his best interest to contact the closest state police barracks, which was located in Grant Haven at that point, which is about 20 miles south of Muskegon. So this is exactly what Jane's father does. And from here, Jane's name was entered into a very rudimentary statewide computer system. After the positive identification of Jane, it was the duty of the Grand Haven Barracks to contact Jane's family and inform them of their daughter's untimely demise. Initially, the police look into Jane's boyfriend, however, they could find nothing linking him to the young woman's murder. They learned that he had had a tutoring session at roughly 6 p.m. the previous night, at which point the police decided to focus their investigation on Jane's room. Jane's roommate knew nothing about the individual who was going to be driving her. They did find a sheet of paper located on Jane's desk with a man's name and phone number on it. However, when they called upon this young man, he had no idea who Jane was, nor did he have any idea why Jane had his phone number. Police began to suspect that whoever it was that had given Jane a ride had given the false name of a student on campus who was known to them. Obviously, given the similarities to the other two murders, they very quickly begin to think that this crime is a continuation of the others. Although, as already stated, they have very little, if anything, to go on. As the police are trying to piece all of this together, officers in Ann Arbor are sent reeling. This is on March 25th, when a county surveyor discovers the body of a deceased woman lying upon a blue jacket behind an abandoned home on Earhart Road. And this is not terribly far from where the body of Joan Shell was discovered. In fact, it was a few hundred yards away. This young woman was completely nude and had been savagely beaten. This particular crime marked a dramatic escalation in the level of brutality shown to victims, with one investigator stating that it was the most barbaric and brutal crime scene he had ever seen. The victim had been beaten savagely, with the facial bones all but completely obliterated. Most of her upper torso was also heavily bruised. The thing that disturbed the officers the most, however, was that a tree branch had been taken and inserted into the victim's vaginal cavity. This branch was soaked with blood pretty much all the way down, leading investigators to believe that it was probably the instrument of death used against this young woman. The body had been posed similar to Jean, with the left arm up on the head. However, the man who discovered her had actually tripped over the corpse, dislodging the arm so that it rested just above the top of the mutilated skull. Officers deduced that the victim had been killed elsewhere, as other than the blood that was discovered on the tree branch, there did not appear to be any blood at the crime scene. They were hampered in this investigation by heavy rains in the evening and days prior to the discovery of the young woman. The victim was described as 5'4", slender, roughly 115 pounds, with long light brown hair, and the coroner found that she had been dead for 24 to 36 hours. There was also extreme welting on the body, indicating the victim had been beaten with a belt and restrained. There was also a piece of cloth found inside the victim's mouth, all the way back in the trachea, which was later determined to have been a part of the victim's shirt. Investigators surmised that the shirt had been placed in the victim's mouth to muffle the screams. Clothing was found near the body. A blue t-shirt, jeans, a dark blue windbreaker, which the girl was lying on, and a pair of loafers, which were set just beneath each a corresponding foot, as though the perpetrator had been staging the crime scene. The police canvassed the neighborhood and surrounding areas and learned from a college student who lived in a nearby home that on Sunday night, at some point between 9 and 9:30, as he was outside calling for his dog, he had heard what sounded like a single lone scream emanating from the general direction that the girl's body was found. Another resident who lived just near the intersection of Earnhardt Road and Geddes Road told investigators that on Sunday night, two vehicles had been in that general vicinity. A red sedan, which she thought may have been a Pontiac, and a small white coupe, although she was unable to give a make or model. The witness believed that it had been a foreign vehicle. Now, the red car had turned onto Geddes, while the white vehicle had gone right onto Geddes. She was unable to give any other information other than the fact that she believed the time she had seen the vehicles was somewhere between 10 and 11 that evening. They very quickly discovered the identification of the victim, as the previous day, March 24th, a 16-year-old high school student had been reported as missing, named Marilyn Skelton. Marilyn was known to police as a narcotics user and small-time seller. She had last been seen at a local drive-in 2 days prior to the discovery of her body. Marilyn had a history of run-ins with the police, unfortunately, often running away from home. Being acquainted with the authorities, police went to the areas they knew Marilyn had hung out with and began looking for her known associates to try and piece together an idea of the young girl's last known movements. It was discovered that she had been in the company of her father, who was preparing to move, that the man had dropped her off on the side of the road as he was in the act of moving. Friends had received phone calls from her around 4 o'clock on March 23rd. She had asked one friend if she could drive out and pick her up. This friend had suggested that Marilyn hitch a ride to the McKinney Union at Eastern Michigan University, at which point the two of them could meet up. Now this friend, along with her boyfriend, arrived at the campus somewhere around 4:15. However, Marilyn never arrived. So the two began calling around to the various people that they knew Marilyn knew, and no one had any idea where the young girl was. By 10 o'clock that evening, March 23rd, everyone is pretty well hysterical that Marilyn has gone missing. Something has happened to her. One friend drove over to the house that Marilyn's father had just vacated, only to discover that it was deserted. Contacting her parents, they learned that they too had not seen the young girl. At 12:30 a.m. on Sunday, Marilyn's friends contacted the state police in Ypsilanti and informed them that Marilyn was missing. Unfortunately for Marilyn, at this point in time, the state police's operating procedures were only to begin a search if an individual's next of kin reported them as missing, and as the individuals who had reported Marilyn missing were not related to her, the file was basically pushed off to the side. Roughly 24 hours later, Marilyn's mother calls and puts in a missing persons report. At this point, it goes out on the wire to all state police to be on the lookout for a missing, possibly endangered teen. Obviously, the police begin questioning all of Marilyn's friends and known associates. None of them can give any reason as to why someone would have done this to the young girl, with the exception of an African-American man from Detroit who her boyfriend stated Marilyn owed money to. Further checking showed that this man had not done anything to the young girl, and that no one had seen Marilyn get into any cars. The police did receive a number of tips, however, that all seemed to lead to dead ends. People placing Marilyn getting inside of hippie microbuses and at various parties. The police learned early on that a rumor was making the rounds that Marilyn had been hit, that is, had been assassinated by rival narcotics dealers who were angry at her for cutting in on their action. The police attempted to track down the veracity of these rumors. However, they were never able to get anything concrete that led them to believe that Marilyn had, in fact, been a victim of a murder for hire. Because of Marilyn's murder and the subsequent news reporting on it, a feeling of foreboding, of fear, began to creep into the Ann Arbor Ypsilanti communities as people began discussing the fact that four young women had been murdered brutally in less than 2 years, three of whom were college students, and all of whom showed some type of sexual disturbance, be it their genitals being exposed or actual sexual assault having taken place. The police attempted to quell this unrest, however, as the news of Marilyn's death reverberated around the community, it became harder and harder for the police to suppress these feelings that were growing in the populace or to give any concrete, solid answers to a terrified public. The police were refusing to link any of these cases, despite the fact that the public and media were doing this and were very vocal about it. The closest any of the police departments came during this period of time to admitting that there may be anything interconnecting between these crimes was to say they have 4 unsolved murders in 2 years. We'll be back in just a moment. You've heard me talk about it before, peeps and freaks. Chinese Mandarin is the number one in-demand language globally in the international job market. And I have a brand new sponsor this week just for you. Chinese teacher Mary. Mary goes deep into learning Mandarin, much the same way I go deep into covering true crime cases, ensuring that every single student not only understands pronunciation and sentence structure, but that they can differentiate between tones, read the language, and speak it fluently. I have never come across another Chinese teacher quite like Mary, because while she likes to have fun, and believe me, Mary is absolutely hilarious, she takes the job of teaching foreigners Chinese extremely seriously. So what I want you to do right now is go to tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary, follow her, subscribe to her, come to her class, which is held 3 times a day. Support her and learn from her. Because I can almost guarantee you that after one lesson with Mary, you're going to realize that there is not a single teacher out there who is as dedicated to teaching as she is. Again, that's tinyurl.com/ChineseTeacherMary. Or just look for the link in the description. Hey there, D&Ders, your friend Ian here with another brand new sponsor this week. Artwork by Katie. Now, as the son of a fairly successful artist, I grew up around the art world, saw many different styles of art. I know good art from bad, and I can honestly say that in addition to being a good friend, Katie is one of the best artists I have ever had the pleasure of seeing. Her works of art, be it drawings or paintings, are absolutely amazing. And Katie doesn't just do original works of art, she also does commission pieces. So if you're looking for that perfect piece of art to offset the decor in your home, office, or even in your place of business, go check out Artwork by Katie at linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. That's linktr.ee/KatieArtworks. You'll be blown away. What the Ann Arbor Police Department did was to assign 6 detectives from the homicide unit to look specifically into the 2 crimes that had taken place in their jurisdiction, along with 2 patrolmen. And not long after this happened, the prosecutor's office set up a task force among all of the various jurisdictions in an effort to try and solve these horrific crimes. Task force didn't just look at crimes that were similar in the area. They also looked abroad. One area of interest to them was in Cape Cod, Massachusetts, where during the preceding 2 months, February and March of 1969, the bodies of 4 young women had been found in shallow graves. Another area they looked to was in southwestern Michigan, in Berrien County, where 4 victims had been murdered during 1965, with ages ranging from 19 all the way up to 60. three of the victims, the 60-year-old, a 37-year-old, and a 7-year-old child who was found to have been sexually molested, were all found inside of a abandoned warehouse at the same time. However, to the best of my knowledge, authorities were never able to link any of these specific crimes to the ones that were going on in Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor. Now, one thing to recall is that during this point in time, the FBI had not yet begun their behavioral sciences unit. So the idea of serial offenders was not even in its infancy. It didn't exist in the lexicon of law enforcement. They knew that these types of people existed, those who would go and commit serial murders, serial rapes, but they didn't understand the psychology or the pathology of such individuals. They did not understand that there were different classifications, and that within these classifications, offenders would share many overlapping characteristics with one another. There were individuals, however, out within the law enforcement community who studied this type of phenomena. One such was an individual by the name of Dr. Ames Roby, who had originally come from Massachusetts, where, as a forensic psychologist, Dr. Roby had helped interview many of the prime suspects in the Boston Strangler crimes. At this point in time, he was working at the Center for Forensic Psychiatry at the Ypsilanti State Hospital, which is actually outside of Ypsilanti, south of Ann Arbor. Roby was one of the few within Massachusetts law enforcement who believed that Albert DeSalvo was not responsible for any of the Boston Strangler murders, which, as we now know, was not the case. We know he's linked to at least one, possibly two of the crimes, but Roby believed the first five killings were all the doing of a single individual, while the subsequent murders were the work of other persons unknown. During the Boston Strangler crimes, Roby had a suspect, a psychotic, who he believed was the best possible suspect for these crimes, an individual whose name has never been revealed, even unto this day. How Dr. Roby comes into our story is he's working in Michigan, these crimes are going on, and he learns that this individual, who goes under a number of different pseudonyms, the most prominent being David Parker, was actually in Ann Arbor. Roby comes across Parker's picture in a local newspaper, and upon seeing it, he immediately begins connecting dots and contacts the Ann Arbor Police Department, letting them know that he doesn't want to involve himself in the investigation. However, he's got this suspect from the Boston Strangler murders that the police never really looked at after they got a false confession from Albert DeSalvo. And this individual just so happens to be in the Ypsilanti Ann Arbor area. So Dr. Roby goes to the Ann Arbor Police Department and he's interviewed by the captain and a sergeant who was working these crimes by the name of Bill Canada. It was his belief that this David Parker, who was said to have an IQ somewhere between 150 and 170 and was a former undergraduate at Harvard, had committed these crimes and was in fact the individual who the police had found the name of on Jane Mixer's desk in her dormitory, as that individual's first name was listed as being David. Dr. Roby believed that his David Parker was smart enough and saw the irony in using a pseudonym from the book The Boston Strangler, the Dis David Parker, to commit these crimes. Basically making this David Parker individual out to be almost a, you know, novelesque supervillain type character. Well, obviously, the police were intrigued to learn of all of this information. They began looking into David Parker. They learned fairly quickly that he had not come to Ann Arbor until the fall of 1967. After the first murder had been committed, they then discovered that Parker had not even been in the area during the summer of 1968, thus eliminating him from the second crime. It's interesting to note that the police in Ann Arbor were so immersed in this case that they were already well aware of Parker being in the area, and would later admit that when Dr. Roby had contacted them, they had been preparing to contact him, seeking outside help in order to solve this series of frustrating and absolutely brutal murders. Another individual that the task force was looking into was the father of Marilyn's boyfriend, who, according to investigative notes, had tentative ties to the Boston Strangler murders, but also was said to be fixated on the series of slayings going on in the Ypsilanti and Ann Arbor area. So the investigation is really branching out. They're looking into new methods to try and hunt down and discover who this killer is. After Easter break, police issued warnings to the communities, warning students not to take rides from people they didn't know, not to hitchhike, especially females. And at first, they heeded this advice. However, it was soon noted by the press that as the weather grew warmer, April waned into May, females began hitchhiking again in mass. On the morning of, at roughly 6:35 a.m. on the morning of Wednesday, April 16th, a man was driving down Gale Road, which was a desolate stretch of country road outside of Ypsilanti, when he spotted a body in the road. This man drove to a nearby house where he awoke the farmer who lived there, and they contacted the police, who descended quickly. The victim was a young female with reddish hair. She had been slashed repeatedly about the torso and strangled with a length of black electrical cord. She was lying in a bra and a blouse with her lower regions exposed, and police believed she had been sexually assaulted. The girl's body was actually discovered just on the shoulder of the road. The body posed with the legs spread eagle and the arms up above the young girl's head. The blouse and bra that she wore had been pulled up above her chest, which was slashed repeatedly. It was discovered that a piece of the white blouse the young girl wore had been forced inside of her throat. A member of the local press was on scene as the sheriff and other authority figures investigated the crime scene. By the time that afternoon's edition was out, the young girl had been identified as 13-year-old Dawn Lewis Bassam. At the autopsy, it was discovered that in addition to the slashes and stabs present on Dawn's chest, her genitals had also been mutilated, as had her buttocks. Dawn was identified by an officer at the sheriff's department whose own daughter had been friends with Dawn. Dawn had last been seen at 7:30 p.m. on the night of April 17th. She was walking home with another friend from a different friend's house, and they had parted ways during their walk, each to go to their respective homes. It was a walk of less than a mile. This officer, Officer Mulholland, received a phone call from Dawn's mother later that evening, wondering if his daughter was over at the house. Dawn had eaten dinner and left the house sometime around 6 to go to this friend's house. Her mother told officers that she was supposed to have been home before dark. Officer Mulholland informed her mother that her best course of action at the moment was to contact everyone that she could think of to see if she could rouse her daughter, as Dawn was seen as a stand-up young girl who was reliable and could be counted on to do as she was told. He also informed her mother that if she could not locate her daughter, her next best bet was be to contact the Ypsilanti Police Department. At 12:45 a.m. on Wednesday the 16th, Dawn's mother contacted the Ypsilanti Police Department. In the autopsy, it was estimated the time of death was between 8 and 9 p.m. on Tuesday evening. Officers were able to track her movements, noting that she was wearing an orange mohair sweater over a white blouse, blue denim stretch pants, black shoes with straps. After leaving home, she went next door where her older sister lived and asked her brother-in-law if he would drive her to a area called Depot Town, which was really the rundown industrial section of town where all of Dawn's friends hung out. The man agreed and dropped her off at the intersection of Cross and River Street. They learned that after leaving her friend at the railroad tracks to continue her trek home, Dawn had come upon two teenagers who were fishing from a small footbridge. According to both boys, after talking with them for roughly 10 minutes, Dawn asked if they would walk her home, although they declined, informing her that they themselves had to get home. A man reported seeing a young girl moving towards him at roughly 7:30. This man was a train fanatic who would oftentimes come out at night to watch the passing train, and he did so at this night. He stated that the train had passed by, the cook had waved to him, so the police tracked down this train and its crew and learned that a number of crew members had also seen the young girl walking, after which she passed on the railroad street and appears to have vanished. Authorities put her abduction at somewhere between 7:35 and 8 p.m. Asking around, officers quickly learned that Dawn was not the type of girl to accept rides from strangers. Later that day, on the 16th, officers began to recover pieces of Dawn's clothing along Gale Road. A shoe was found along the fence line of a golf course. The second shoe found on the opposite bank of the road. Officers surmised that the perpetrator had tossed one shoe out as he drove to dump the dead girl's body, and then thrown the other one out as he returned from committing the deed. Officers speculated that Dawn had been kept somewhere for a period of time before being murdered, and that her body had remained there until the killer decided it was time to get rid of her. At a news conference held later that day, the sheriff stated, quote, "We figured the girl's body was dumped here not too long before we found it. While it was still dark, say anywhere between 3 and 5 o'clock this morning, naturally the killer didn't want to risk being seen doing it, so he picked the quietest time. But it's plain to us that he wanted her to be easily found. The way the body was left right by the side of the road, so exposed that anybody driving past would have to spot it even before dawn with headlights on. So it looks like this guy, the murderer, is starting to play games with us." Reporter asked whether or not the sheriff, whether or not by his statements, he was trying to indicate that the perpetrator had previously killed. The sheriff responded, quote, "I'm not saying that yet, but I do say there sure seems to be some similarities in the MO of this one and some of the other things that have been going on around here lately." The sheriff then goes on to give a rundown of the cases, which to him bear a striking similarity to Dawn's murder. The sheriff then ended the news conference, refusing to give any more information, including as to whether or not the sheriff's department had any suspects. What no one at this news conference was aware of, however, was that the police believed at this point that they had found the area where Dawn had actually been held, tortured, and murdered. This was an old farmhouse north of Ypsilanti, where a sheriff's deputy who had been sent out with the task of looking for places where a crime such as this may have been committed, discovered a girl's orange mohair sweater. In the crumbling remains of the farmhouse inside the basement, detectives from the state crime lab found pieces of a white blouse. But more than that, as they continued to search, they found traces of fresh blood in a corner of the basement. Officers also discovered powdered pieces of glass on the steps leading into the basement, which were later linked to powdered pieces of glass that had been ground into the soles of Dawn's shoes. Then, just after noon, a searcher of the property discovered a length of black electrical cord in the remnants of the barn. This length of electrical cord was later matched to the piece that had been looped around Dawn's neck and used to kill her. Officers made note that this particular farm was only about a half mile from where the body of the first victim had been discovered in the summer of 1967. After this, the farm was gone over meticulously, as investigators believed they had found the site not only of Dawn's murder, but also of two other victims. We're going to end the episode at this point. I hope that you guys have enjoyed it. Until next time, stay morbid.